Chapter 42. At last this fine old tar was cut down in the fullness of his years and honors. And to her dying day, his poor heartbroken widow believed that, if he had been cut down 15 minutes sooner, he might have been resuscitated. Charles Henry Twain lived during the latter part of the 17th century, and was a zealous and distinguished missionary. He converted 16,000 South Sea Islanders, and taught them that a dog-tooth necklace and a pair of spectacles was not enough clothing to come to divine service in. His poor flock loved him very, very dearly, and when his funeral was over, they got up in a body and came out of the restaurant, with tears in their eyes, and saying, one to another, that he was a good tender missionary, and they wished they had some more of him. Pago de Wawapuketekawis, mighty hunter with a hog eye Twain, adorned the middle of the 18th century, and aided General Braddock with all his heart, to resist the oppressor Washington. It was this ancestor who fired 17 times at our Washington from behind a tree. So far the beautiful romantic narrative in the moral story books is correct, but when that narrative goes on to say that at the 17th round the awe-stricken savage said solemnly that that man was being reserved by the Great Spirit for some mighty mission, and he dared not lift his sacrilegious rifle against him again, the narrative seriously impairs the integrity of history. What he did say was, it ain't no pick, no use. That man so drunk he can't stand still long enough for a man to hit him. I can't afford to fool away any more ammunition on him. That was why he stopped at the 17th round, and it was a good, plain, matter-of-fact reason too, and one that easily commends itself to us by the eloquent, persuasive flavor of probability there is about it. I also enjoyed the storybook narrative, but I felt a marring misgiving that every Indian at Braddock's defeat who fired at a soldier a couple of times too easily grows to 17 in a century, and missed him, jumped to the conclusion that the Great Spirit was reserving that soldier for some grand mission, and so I somehow feared that the only reason why Washington's case is remembered and the others forgotten is that in his the prophecy came true, and in that of the others it didn't. There are not books enough on earth to contain the record of the prophecies Indians and other unauthorized parties have made. But one may carry in his overcoat pockets the record of all the prophecies that have been fulfilled. I will remark here, in passing, that certain ancestors of mine are so thoroughly well known in history by their aliases, that I have not felt it to be worth while to dwell upon them, or even mention them in the order of their birth. Among these may be mentioned Richard Brinsley Twain, alias Guy Fawkes, John Wentworth Twain, alias 16 String Jack, William Hogarth Twain, alias Jack Shepherd, Ananias Twain, alias Baron Munchausen, John George Twain, alias Captain Kidd, and then there are George Francis Twain, Tom Pepper, Nebuchadnezzar, and Balaam's Ass. They all belong to our family, but to a branch of it somewhat distinctly removed from the honorable direct line, in fact, a collateral branch, whose members chiefly differ from the ancient stock in that, in order to acquire the notoriety we have always yearned and hungered for, they have got into a low way of going to jail instead of getting hanged. It is not well, when writing an autobiography, to follow your ancestry down too close to your own time. It is safest to speak only vaguely of your great-grandfather, and then skip from there to yourself, which I now do. I was born without teeth, and there Richard III had the advantage of me, but I was born without a humpback, likewise, and there I had the advantage of him. My parents were neither very poor nor conspicuously honest. But now a thought occurs to me. My own history would really seem so tame contrasted with that of my ancestors, that it is simply wisdom to leave it unwritten until I am hanged. If some other biographies I have read had stopped with the ancestry until a like event occurred, it would have been a felicitous thing for the reading public. How does it strike you? How to tell a story, the humorous story and American development. Its difference from comic and witty stories, I do not claim that I can tell a story as it ought to be told. I only claim to know how a story ought to be told, for I have been almost daily in the company of the most expert storytellers for many years. There are several kinds of stories, but only one difficult kind, the humorous. I will talk mainly about that one. The humorous story is American, the comic story is English, the witty story is French. The humorous story depends for its effect upon the manner of the telling, the comic story and the witty story upon the matter. The humorous story may be spun out to great length, and may wander around as much as it pleases, and arrive nowhere in particular. But the comic and witty stories must be brief, and end with a point. The humorous story bubbles gently along, the others burst. The humorous story is strictly a work of art, high and delicate art, and only an artist can tell it. But no art is necessary in telling the comic and the witty story. Anybody can do it. The art of telling a humorous story, understand, I mean by word of mouth, not print, was created in America, and has remained at home. The humorous story is told gravely. The teller does his best to conceal the fact that he even dimly suspects that there is anything funny about it. But the teller of the comic story tells you beforehand that it is one of the funniest things he has ever heard, then tells it with eager delight, and is the first person to laugh when he gets through. And sometimes, if he has had good success, he is so glad and happy that he will repeat the up of it and glance around from face to face, collecting applause, and then repeat it again. It is a pathetic thing to see. Very often, of course, the rambling and disjointed humorous story finishes with a nub, point, snapper, or whatever you like to call it. Then the listener must be alert, for in many cases the teller will divert attention from that nub by dropping it in a carefully casual and indifferent way, with the pretense that he does not know it is a nub. Artemus Ward used that trick a good deal. Then when the belated audience presently caught the joke, he would look up with innocent surprise, as if wondering what they had found to laugh at. Dan Setchell used it before him, Nyan Riley and others use it today. But the teller of the comic story does not slur the nub, he shouts it at you every time. And when he prints it, in England, France, Germany, and Italy, he italicizes it, puts some whopping exclamation points after it, and sometimes explains it in a parenthesis. All of which is very depressing, and makes one want to renounce joking, and lead a better life. Let me set down an instance of the comic method, using an anecdote which has been popular all over the world for 1200 or 1500 years. The teller tells it in this way. The wounded soldier, in the course of a certain battle, a soldier whose leg had been shot off appealed to another soldier who was hurrying by to carry him to the rear, informing him at the same time of the loss which he had sustained. Whereupon the generous son of Mars, shouldering the unfortunate, proceeded to carry out his desire. The bullets and cannonballs were flying in all directions, and presently one of the latter took the wounded man's head off without, however, his deliverer being aware of it. In no long time he was hailed by an officer, who said, "Where are you going with that carcass?" "To the rear, sir, he's lost his leg." "His leg, forsooth?" responded the astonished officer. "You mean his head, you booby." Whereupon the soldier dispossessed himself of his burden, and stood looking down upon it in great perplexity. At length he said, "It is true, sir, just as you have said." Then after a pause he added, "But he told me it was his leg." Here the narrator bursts into explosion after explosion of thunderous hoarse laughter, repeating that nub from time to time through his gasping and shriekings and suffocatings. It takes only a minute and a half to tell that in its comic story form, and isn't worth the telling after all. Put into the humorous story form, it takes 10 minutes, and is about the funniest thing I have ever listened to, as James Whitcomb Riley tells it. He tells it in the character of a dull-witted old farmer who has just heard it for the first time, thinks it is unspeakably funny, and is trying to repeat it to a neighbor. But he can't remember it, so he gets all mixed up, and wanders helplessly round and round, putting in tedious details that don't belong in the tale and only retard it, taking them out conscientiously, and putting in others that are just as useless, making minor mistakes now and then and stopping to correct them, and explain how he came to make them, remembering things which he forgot to put in their proper place and going back to put them in there, stopping his narrative a good while in order to try to recall the name of the soldier that was hurt, and finally remembering that the soldier's name was not mentioned, and remarking placidly that the name is of no real importance, anyway better, of course, if one knew it, but not essential, after all, and so on, and so on, and so on. The teller is innocent and happy, and pleased with himself, and has to stop every little while, to hold himself in and keep from laughing outright, and does hold in, but his body quakes in a jelly-like way with interior chuckles, and at the end of the 10 minutes the audience have laughed until they are exhausted, and the tears are running down their faces. The simplicity and innocence and sincerity and unconsciousness of the old farmer are perfectly simulated, and the result is a performance which is thoroughly charming and delicious. This is art and fine and beautiful, and only a master can compass it, but a machine could tell the other story. To string incongruities and absurdities together in a wandering, and sometimes purposeless way, and seem innocently unaware that they are absurdities, is the basis of the American art, if my position is correct. Another feature is the slurring of the point. A third is the dropping of a studied remark apparently without knowing it, as if one were thinking aloud. The fourth and last is the pause. Artemus Ward dealt in numbers 3 and 4 a good deal. He would begin to tell with great animation something which he seemed to think was wonderful, then lose confidence, and after an apparently absent-minded pause add an incongruous remark in a soliloquizing way, and that was the remark intended to explode the mind, and it did. For instance, he would say eagerly, excitedly, I once knew a man in New Zealand who hadn't a tooth in his head. Here his animation would die out. A silent reflective pause would follow, then he would say dreamily, and as if to himself, and yet that man could beat a drum better than any man I ever saw. The pause is an exceedingly important feature in any kind of story, and a frequently recurring feature too. It is a dainty thing, and delicate, and also uncertain and treacherous, for it must be exactly the right length, no more, and no less, or it fails of its purpose and makes trouble. If the pause is too short, the impressive point is passed, and the audience have had time to divine that a surprise is intended, and then you can't surprise them, of course. On the platform I used to tell a Negro ghost story that had a pause in front of the snapper on the end, and that pause was the most important thing in the whole story. If I got it the right length precisely, I could spring the finishing ejaculation with effect enough to make some impressible girl deliver a startled little yelp and jump out of her seat, and that was what I was after. This story was called The Golden Arm, and was told in this fashion. You can practice with it yourself, and mind you look out for the pause, and get it right. The Golden Arm, once upon a time day was a momsus mean man, and he live way out in the prairie all alone by hisself, except he had a wife. And bimaby she died, and he tuck and toted her way out die in the prairie and buried her. Well, as he had a golden arm all solid gold, from the shoulder down. He was poful mean, poful, and that night he couldn't sleep, cause he want that golden arm so bad. When it come midnight he couldn't stand it no more, so he get up, he did, and tuck his lantern and shoved out through the storm and dug her up and got the golden arm, and he bent his head down gin the wind, and plowed and plowed and plowed through the snow. Then all on a sudden he stop, make a considerable pause here, and look startled, and take a listening attitude, and say, why Lan, what's that? And he listen and listen and the wind say, set your teeth together, and imitate the wailing and wheezing sing-song of the wind, bzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzz Way back yonder where the grave is, he hear a voice. He hear a voice all mixed up in the wind, can't hardly tell them apart. Z-Z-Z-Z-Z-Z-W-H-O-G-O-T-M-Y-G-O-L-D-E-N-Arm. You must begin to shiver violently now.
And he begin to shiver and shake, and say, oh, my land. And the wind blow the lantern out, and the snow and sleet blow in his face and most choke him, and he start a blowin' knee deep toward home most dead. He so scared, and pooty soon he hear the voice of gin, and, pause, it is common after him.
Z-Z-Z-Z-Z-Z-Z-Z-W-H-O-G-O-T-M-Y-G-O-L-D-E-N-Arm. When he get to the pasture he hear the gin, closer now, and a comin'. A common back die in the dark and the storm, repeat the wind and the voice. When he get to the house he rush upstairs and jump in the bed and kiver up, head and ears, and lay da shiverin' and shakin', and then way out da he hear the gin. And a common. And bimaby he hear, pause, odd, listening attitude, pat, 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 it's a comin' upstairs. Then he hear the latch, and he know it's in the room. Then pooty soon he know it's a standin' by the bed. Pause. Then he know it's a bendin' down over him and he can't scarcely get his breath. Then he seem to feel somethin' cold, right down most agin his head. Pause. Then the voice say, right at his ear, dash H-O-G-O-T-M-Y-G-O-L-D-E-N-Arm.
You must wail it out very plaintively and accusingly. Then you stare steadily and impressively into the face of the farthest gone auditor, a girl, preferably, and let that awe-inspiring pause begin to build itself in the deep hush. When it has reached exactly the right length, jump suddenly at that girl and yell, you've got it.
Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.